Darryl, D-A-R-Y-L. Yeah, it's +641 057 5897.
We had closed it and reopened it. We guessed. I knew it had all.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, everybody.
It's not on, is it?
We're working it. All of us start a little slow. Can you hear me now? I have a very, have a good voice. Oh, there you go. Now I have my voice of God going. Fantastic. Good afternoon. I almost got you there. Good afternoon. Thanks, guys. Appreciate the support. It's been a long day so far, huh? So thank you all for coming back and welcome back to part two of Newcomer Sunday. So as promised, we have very dynamic speakers this afternoon with riveting information. It will be. So this morning, the collective we, as I exit stage left and my partner in crime, Jeannie, led you through with our global stakeholder engagement team, we took you through the building blocks of ICANN. So basically going over who we are, what our mission is, how we get our work done through the multi-stakeholder model. So we're going to dig a little deeper this afternoon, give you a bit of a better understanding of these pieces and parts of ICANN that you, the community, work in to get the work of ICANN completed. So we're going to start, let's go a little further here. We aren't going to back you up. We are going to start this afternoon with policy support, and I'm going to pass over to Rob Hogarth, and I know he's going to talk a little further about that title and why that title is important about policy support and what we do as staff and what our expectations are and what the community does in building policy at ICANN. Rob?
Thank you, Janice. Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Rob Hogarth. I'm with the ICANN Policy Development Support Team. My title is Senior Director of Policy and Community Engagement, and we may touch a little bit upon that a little later in my remarks. You may have mentioned this morning, Janice, but we're not usually in a room this big, and nor are the chairs this comfortable, so I hope you all appreciate that, and I will be watching to see if anyone's eyes are getting heavy right after lunch. But this really is very impressive in terms of space. Janice may also have told you that when we do have the main sessions, our meetings team is trying to limit us all to this space, so I'm glad to see that you've already got some good practice on that. Today, I'm going to spend just a few minutes sharing with you what we do as really a core function at ICANN. You've heard a lot about what ICANN is. You've heard about what ICANN does. But when you really get to the core work of our community, it's to develop policies, to make sure that policies are implemented appropriately, and to make sure that all of the structures, all of the expectations of the community for how the DNS should be run are followed, and that things are done in a secure, stable way. And we have a number of community groups that are really focused on making sure not only that the mechanisms exist to oversee those policies, but also to affect changes potentially if there are unanticipated consequences, if there are changes in technology or practice that require change. And so there are very elaborate processes that are set up within ICANN for creating new policies, changing old policies, improving policies. I'm not going to go into any of those details with you today, but what I'm going to do is take a step back, talk with you just generally about who participates in the process, how they do it, what they do. And I'll leave for you all to further do research in the ICANN bylaws about what some of the specific processes are. Janice always counsels me that this should be a high-level conversation and discussion, and so that's why I'll try to keep it. You've seen measures of that previous slide before, but what I want to dive into and spend most of my time on today is focusing on our four primary foundational elements of policy development at ICANN. And that is multi-stakeholder, bottom-up, open, and transparent. And there are different aspects of each one of those pillars, if you will, that's important for us to talk about. Concept of multi-stakeholder is very important in a lot of the conversations that are taking place related to the IANA transition discussions that are at the top of everybody's list here in ICANN at the Dublin meeting. But multi-stakeholder, when we talk about the policy development support at ICANN, is fundamentally to ensure that we've got the input and participation from every stakeholder group within the ICANN community to make sure that their voice is heard, to make sure that they have an opportunity to share their points of view, and to help collectively work on solutions. And so the concept of multi-stakeholder not only impacts are you getting the word out to enough people, but it also includes are you getting active participation? Are you getting active listening or information that's being exchanged? It's a very important concept. And we'll talk a little bit more about who those stakeholders are in a moment or two. Before I do that, I always like to get a sense of the room when we do these. We're all divided up into different communities within ICANN. Can I get a show of hands for anybody who's here who would relate themselves to the ASO community? Thank you. How about the CCNSO community? Great, thanks. The GNSO community? The GAC, the Governmental Advisory Committee? Thank you. The ESAC? How about the RSAC? All right, good. Thank you. That helps, and I'll be able to direct my remarks. Some of you may be able to tell me more about your communities than I will, but what I want to do is just set the stage and give you a context of everybody. The second major foundational element in policy development work at ICANN is this concept of bottom-up. And sometimes people mispronounce it. Sometimes people call it bottoms-up. Some people, you know, have different perspectives on it. But the underlying philosophy is simply that policy development work is not something that is developed at the board of directors, not something that's dictated by any aspect of the ICANN community. It's really a sense that policy ideas, concepts, changes in how we do our work come literally from members of the community. People who are directly experiencing or involved in some of those issues. And that's what underlies a lot of our work within the various communities. And there are a number of processes that are set up in the bylaws that create channels for different policy development activities to begin. And so we look at bottom up from two perspectives. One, where do the ideas come from? Where do the concepts come from? And then two, how do we do it? You know, what are the exchanges that need to take place? What are some of the activities and the underlying ways that we do those activities? How can we ensure that they really are coming from the community and going to the board of directors as recommendations? Because that's essentially how it works. The bottom-up process produces recommendations that flow up through the community and are then basically reviewed by the board of directors with the expectation that in most cases, if not a rubber stamp, which we, you know, just recognize as thank you, we'll take it, but that there's a recognition that processes were followed, that everyone had an opportunity to participate, and almost a certification by the board to take on those recommendations and then direct subsequent steps. The third area is open, and I want to compare the two. Open and transparent don't mean the same thing, and some folks who don't have English as their first language, they get confused between the two. The concept of openness relates back to multi-stakeholderism, and that is that all of the policy development processes are open to all of the stakeholders. The concept there, of course, is that you know that a proceeding is actually taking place. You know that there's an issue or matter that needs to be discussed. Two, that you actually can have a voice in that. Three, that if you don't choose to participate, that you can be aware of what's going on. And three, that you, at every step in the process, have an opportunity to participate. Concept, again, of openness is really seen in an ICANN meeting, right? You don't have to pay any money to come. When you do show up, almost all of the meetings, with few exceptions, are open the door and walk in. And there's typically, although they've disappeared and I'm holding one of them, a microphone so that you can immediately participate, so you can express your point of view. So that's the concept of openness. And as a policy development support team, we work with community leaders to make sure that We are creating those channels. We're creating those opportunities either through promoting a new working group or through working on different documentation and opportunities for written input, but basically creating opportunities for people to know what's going on. One of the fundamental aspects of policy development in ICANN is we follow a working group model of policy development work. And the working group model assumes that there is a very defined charter that tells the group your expectations, what do we want you to get out of it, how should you conduct your affairs, when do we want the work done by, all of that gets laid out. And then the working group model also assumes that there is active and ongoing participation. So that means telephone calls, webinars, other ways of the group getting together or contributing points of view. So all of those are aspects of openness. And we could talk for 15 or 20 minutes on each of those aspects, but I'm trying to keep it at a high level today. Now let's relate that to transparency. As many of you know, you may not have come to an ICANN meeting before, but you've observed what we do or you're involved in the ICANN world in some way, shape, or form, as a number of you who raised your hand suggested to me. Well, you can't participate in everything. And one of the recognitions that we have at ICANN is that participating in ICANN may be equal to participating in a number of other organizations that you're involved in. You may have a full-time job that's related to the DNS, or you may be a consultant, lawyer, member or government staff who has other responsibilities. So the concept of transparency is to make sure that you can follow or be aware of what's going on without necessarily having to participate at every step in the process. And that's what we mean by transparency. So are we alerting you and alerting interested parties that an endeavor is beginning? Are we keeping you updated on what's going on? Can you go to the website to find out information about it? What type of information gets produced? That would include email updates, postings on web pages or wiki pages. Again, the concept that even if you aren't participating, that you can see what's going on. And within working groups, our team works very hard to not only produce those reports, but also produce the raw data, if you will. Most, if not all, of a working group's deliberations are recorded and transcribed. So, I mean, if you were very intensely interested in a particular issue, you could literally follow every word that's spoken on it. You can go back at the end and say, well, where did it start? What were the opinions that were expressed? Who expressed them? The other final important piece of that is that with all of you participating, ICANN wants to create an environment where everybody understands where everyone else is coming from. And so the important aspect there is every participant in the policy development process shares with the other participants a statement of interest. And it's very important, particularly in discussions, to understand where somebody else might be coming from. Some people confuse a statement of interest with a conflict of interest. Most of the work that we do, we recognize that every one of you has an interest. And it's not a matter of a conflict of interest. It's that you're participating in the ICANN world because you want to promote a particular point of view or because you want to get a particular policy put in place. And so the important aspect of a statement of interest is it gives you the opportunity to understand everybody else around the table, what position they're not only interested in, but more importantly, where are they come from? Who do they work for? What's their background? Do they have any financial interests? Not to exclude anyone, but again, to help the discussions, to help improve how things are going along. I think I've spent a lot of time on that slide, so let's move on. Wait, this is a very quick slide. I already went through it, essentially, who? And you've shared with me who. But what's important about this slide is to share with you that there is a fundamental difference between two very critical types of groups in ICANN policy development. You have the supporting organizations who are responsible for creating policy recommendations for the ICANN Board of Directors. And then the board utilizes a number of different groups, provide them advice on policy development matters. And so the way it's set up is you have a supporting organization responsible for the numbering issues. That's the ASO. You've got a supporting organization responsible for generic top-level domain issues. That's the GNSO. And you've got a supporting organization in the CCNSO that's responsible for CC matters. And so each of these groups has a particular culture, a particular group of people who are experts in that area and focus on that work. Now, again, the working group model of policy development permits broader input, but the individual SOs take on the mantle or the jurisdiction, if you will, to take on certain matters that are particular to their community. The advisory committees have developed over time. ICANN didn't always have four advisory committees, but they all play critical roles. The at-large advisory committee, of course, focusing on users of the Internet. And we'll be having discussions over the next couple of years in the sense of ICANN accountability and the IANA transition in terms of, well, how are users structured and how does that work and how are they involved in a productive way? The governmental advisory committee to provide the perspective of sovereign governments around the world and how they're impacted by changes in the DNS. And then critical to the security and stability of the Internet, the board has technical advisors in the Security and Stability Advisory Committee and in the Root Server System Advisory Committee who provide very detailed information about the impact of policies. Again, when there are changes in technology, being able to advise the board about the impact of certain policies. And in many respects, it's also important to note that while the advisory committees can comment or provide the board advice on a particular policy recommendation, they can also initiate policy ideas. And when an advisory committee comes to the board and says, we think you should consider X, we think you should look into Y, then the board will move to directing one of the SOs to actually make a decision or start a policy development process. So all of those are very important elements. And again, I could talk for 45 minutes about each one of the different groups, but we'll keep it at that high level with those two channels. This is just a pure graphic depiction for you that there are very clear processes that exist and that are ironclad in the ICANN bylaws for how the GNSO and the CCNSO conduct their policy development activities. Not intended for you to be able to read any part of the snake or the smartphone app graph there, with a couple of exceptions. And this is more a slide to key off for me the importance of reinforcing for you that when you look at a policy development process, and when you think back to the foundational elements, the pillars of policy development at ICANN, is that at every stage of the process, there's an opportunity for broader community input. Again, there's a working group that gets together. Not everyone can participate. So at certain key points within these processes, a written document gets produced, put on the website, and interested parties have anywhere from 40 days plus to comment, participate. So that's the what of policy processes. And at any point in time, you can ask me about those, ask any of my colleagues about particular elements of that. But again, let's keep that at a high level. I'm already seeing heavy eyes. I don't want to get into the details of some of these, and then you'll all be asleep. Next slide.
And Rob, I'll just say that you pointed out how small those pictographs were. So this presentation is in the posted schedule. So if you click into this session, you will find this presentation that you can download and, you know, read ad nauseum, but those smaller pictographs will come much more to life, and they'll stay there forevermore. We never take those off. So any of these finer points, you can go and reference later on for yourself.
Thank you, Janice. Tools. Well, we've talked a little bit about what we do. We've talked about how we do it. We talk about who participates in it. But fundamentally, we need a tremendous number of tools to help make this happen. And these include, when you're looking at the working group model of policy development, primarily meeting support. That's telephone calls and in-person meetings. That's webinars and the rest. Each one of these elements, you would be surprised, takes a substantial amount of background activity. We calculate for every hour of community work, there's about 2 hours of staff work. when you talk about preparing for the meeting, when you talk about then producing documentation after any meeting. And so there's a tremendous amount of commitment that ICANN makes from a support standpoint to make sure that communities have the resources that they need to actually get the work done. These also include what I referred to in the past as public comments. I like to refer to public comments more as public input. Again, under this concept of openness and transparency, we want to make sure that people have opportunities to provide their points of view about particular proposals that their fellow community members have updated. When many of you think about public comments, you probably think about typing up something or writing something. The critical aspect of an ICANN meeting is that you're actually here in person. And again, you know, referencing the microphones you see in a lot of the rooms. When you know that everything's being recorded, everything's being transcribed, you've got staff taking notes, basically the opportunity to speak in person in front of a microphone is also a very important element. There are a number of reasons for that. While ICANN generally operates in the English language, we want to make sure that people from all areas of the globe have an opportunity to provide their input. And so why we have a wonderful array of supporting interpreters for our in-person meetings, and I see a number of you with the headphones, because you may not be most comfortable speaking in English or writing in English. And so our infrastructure gives us the capability to, you know, bring in contributions from people for whom English is not their first language. And that's very important. Again, when you talk about, you know, the population of internet users, the majority of internet users don't speak in English. So it's very important as an organization to be able to have a more global participation, literally from around the world. The other pieces that exist, and it's interesting, this concept of collaboration mechanisms, what's that? That's the concept of constantly looking and trying to decide what else can be used. Can we use surveys to get input? We've had past meetings where we've used Twitter to get input, so that people provide aspects of their work. We experiment with different types of streaming technology so that people who are participating can use video, can use other mechanisms for interacting with their colleagues. And that's something that we're always looking to expand the horizons on. And some of you may have some really good ideas from that perspective, and I'd love to hear them. The other things are much more traditional, publications and webinars, just mechanisms and abilities for us as a team and for the community leaders to share what's going on. Go to the next slide, thanks. We're not going to go through and identify and for me to give you a biography of every member of our team, but the reason I share this slide is to note that we do really have a global coverage in terms of the backgrounds of our staff, their languages, their time zones, and the communities for whom they're responsible. We structure ourselves in a way that specific staff are identified with specific communities for support. There are some of us, like myself, there's probably about five or six of us, who aren't assigned to a particular community, take on the more broad responsibility of making sure that everybody is resourced. We can look at perhaps a bigger picture and identify areas of concern, areas that need additional support, and that also works out quite well. We like to joke that we cover about 19 or 20 hours out of the day. So literally one of us is actively on call and working around most of the clock. What's interesting, and one of the challenges I think that someone new to ICANN looks at is, well, how long does it take all this to get done? What good is having 24-hour support service or 20-hour support service when your processes take 6 months or a year, or one working group that we're concluding our work on has been 6 years in the making? The important thing, again, is that many of you are not doing this on a full-time basis. You don't have the time to wait for 3 weeks to get feedback, or that one time you're actively focused on it, you'd like an answer back fairly quickly. So that's what we as a team like to try to do. We don't have the same SLAs like our GDD colleagues have, where they want to be able to get back to you within a certain window of time. But we do have a commitment that we do some immediate follow-up and make sure that we answer questions from as many folks as possible as quickly as we can. And then the final box that we have on the slide is that even though we have 27 people, we're not experts on every aspect of the DNS. I think we all appreciate that there are certain areas that we specialize in or know a lot about, but when you're talking about some more technical issues, you may not know all of it. And so our resource allocation allows us to be able to go out and bring in experts. Sometimes they're members of the community, like all of you. Sometimes they're academics or more scientifically based folks, engineers who can do that. How am I on time? Have I killed my time yet? 5 minutes, okay. Well, ultimately, why do we do this? And what's our job as a policy team? What it all comes down to, and one of the misnomers that even some employees have when they first start is, okay, I'm ready. Rob Hogarth is here. I'm ready to develop some policy. That's not how it works. The policy that is developed at ICANN is developed by the community. It's developed by you, by your colleagues, by other folks in the community. And so our job as an ICANN staff is to help support that effort. That's our job. It's not to come up with the concepts or ideas, but it's to help you focus on those times when you can really use your brains to come up with ideas, to debate, to negotiate with your fellow community members. And so our job is also to support you, make sure that we've got enough people participating, that the calls are going out appropriately to tell people about what's going on. And then the very important aspect, of course, of managing the processes. Community leaders can spend 20 hours a week, some of the chairs of the various SOs and ACs, between the actual policy work they do, between their communications with senior management, where they're constantly being asked for the sense of the community and for feedback on particular items. They spend a tremendous amount of time. Some of the council members on the different SOs and ACs spend 10, 15, 20 hours a week prior to an ICANN meeting, reading up, getting available. It's our job as staff to put as much work as we can into briefings, making sure that people have the documentation that they need, helping to edit the documents, pull them together. All those aspects are really important of the work that we do. We're also from time to time called referees of the process. It's our job to know what the details are of a particular methodology or a particular proceeding. So people will often ask, how many days do we have before we have to turn this back? Oh, we're supposed to be open, so we have to have our agenda done 10 days before a meeting. Okay, staff, is that to after a meeting? Is the transcript provided within 24 hours, a week? What's the standard? And it's our job to know that and make sure that that's done. So those are all the pieces that we use as a group of policy development support teammates to work with and basically to partner and collaborate with you and other members of the community. We have a number of tools to ensure that those of you who are very interested or just mildly interested or those who have to focus at a particular point in time can use to become familiar. One of the most important ones that I'd like to provide as a commercial for all of you is our monthly policy update. On a monthly basis, we produce a written document, runs anywhere from 20 to 25 pages, which breaks down the work of the community into different SOs and ACs and just shares some highlights with you. Tells you what's going on or what the latest information about some particular proceedings. We try to break it down in a way that you don't have to read all 25 pages. You just want to focus on the ASO or the RSAC or the GAC, and it allows you to do that. In the same way, we look to produce that document in a variety of languages. Right now, the 6 UN languages, and we're always open to somebody else suggesting we should add to that so that there can be broader distribution of that information. We also, something that's not on the slide, We provide prior to every ICANN meeting a series of webinars to alert people who are coming to the meeting about the issues that are going to be explored, some of the highlights of a meeting and the rest, and whether this is just going to be your only ICANN meeting or whether you're intending to come to other ones in the future, I would definitely recommend that you either participate live in some of those webinars or otherwise just get a hold of the recording so you can listen to it on your airplane flight coming to the meeting. So that's an overview of what we do and how we do it. In the past, folks have asked specific questions about particular communities. Some groups ask no questions. I am here today and for the rest of the ICANN meeting If you see me in the halls, if you want to send me an email at robert.hogarth@icann.org, I'll be delighted to chat with you, give you perspectives or details on any aspect of our work. And I look forward to many of you in the future being on the mailing lists for some of our working groups and other activities. We'd really like to have your contributions. Thanks very much.
And while we wait for our next speakers to either come up here, Christine and Russ, or if you'd like the handheld mic, you can have either one. Are there any questions for Rob before he exits stage left? We have one back there. We have a microphone. There we go.
My name is Boniface Witaba from Kenya. As far as public comment is concerned, criteria is used to adapt some of the comments from the public or reject them.
All the public comments that are submitted, well, let me step back. Public comments, again, can take a number of different forms. Are you talking about written comments or just verbal comments?
Thank you. I understand there's usually a window for the public to comment on the website. So what criteria is used as far as those comments that are posted online, for instance?
Great, thank you. In terms of accepting comments, there's basically no criteria as long as it isn't spam. And we get plenty of spam from time to time, so our IT team has created basic restrictions and a process where if you do submit a comment over the web, you get an email back asking you to confirm the submission. But in terms of assessment or evaluation, 99% of the ICANN comment periods are for comment literally by anyone who's interested in the issue. In terms of how those comments are assessed by any particular working group, you have to appreciate that a public comment solicitation, we call it, can be made by a number of different organizations or groups. It could be made by a working group. That's in the context of policy development, certainly. But it can also be the ICANN staff. It can come directly from the board. It can come on issues of the ICANN budget or on particular policy development issues. In terms of specific policy development, we take a couple of different approaches. First, any comments that come in get summarized by the staff. So there is a report that is generated by the staff that says, group that asked for the comments, these are the comments that came in. These are who they're from. These are what people said. And here's generally, you know, an analysis of the types of feedback that you got. A working group can choose to just read the summary or they can go through every comment. We have a tool that we use that's a best practice that we use most of the time. We will create as staff a matrix that lists all the different comments and ultimately notes what the resolution of those comments are. And generally we work with the working groups to go through each of the comments. You would be surprised. Some of the comments are very high principles. You know, you should do this, you should do that. Others are very specific. On page 12, paragraph 3, you should change of to and. You know, so the comments can take a variety of different forms. But the way I like to describe it is the communities that are accepting the comments and are asking, they're not looking for a vote. They're looking for the quality of your idea, the quality of your thought. And so you might be an individual, but you know a lot about a particular topic. And so in that case, that could be the most influential comment. In another circumstance, many comments we receive are either from a trade association or from another SO and AC within ICANN. And when we get those, sometimes someone will look at them from a working group and go, oh, well, my goodness, the GAC said this, or the ALAC said that. And that might influence a particular group. But in general, I think what really drives a lot of the feedback and the assessment of comments is the quality of the input. I hope that answered your question. Thank you.
Rob, thank you very much. And in order to keep ourselves on time, if you have any other questions for Rob, you can either follow him out the door. He doesn't mind. He might be going somewhere, but you can walk and talk. But we need to
It's a very quick question.
So, or we don't need to stop the questions.
Okay, sorry. Rob, thanks a million for that. That was very, very clear. I just want to know, the model you have is consensual and bottom-up for policy. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a specific example whereby two or more stakeholders had radically different policy ideas, and how did ICANN resolve them? Or if they haven't resolved them, what kind of unresolved conflicts still exist in terms of ICANN's work. Thank you.
And Rob, I do need to interrupt because I was saying that not to be funny, but we have speakers who have another place to go, and so our timing is very important. So, Rob, if you could wrap it up as quickly as you possibly could.
Sure, and we can have some offline conversations as well. I think a perfect example would be Who Is. For those of you not familiar with Who Is, the concept of registration information by who holds the TLDs, you know, who owns the particular domain name. That's been an issue that ICANN's been working on for many years in a number of different contexts, and it's one where you have substantially different opinions based upon some very important principles of different groups. And the way that gets resolved is, in many respects, ongoing debate. You know, you don't have a resolution, and so you end up having to find different ways to maybe pick up different pieces or different parts of a debate and set aside the areas where you can't achieve consensus. That's something we could talk about for a good period of time, but that would be one example. I hope that's helpful. Great. Again, thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob, once again. Thanks very much. We're going to skip a little bit out of order. You can see we moved ahead to DNS industry. And we have with us Christine Willett and Russ Weinstein, who will be talking more about the Global Domains Division. And I hand it off to you, Christine.
Thank you, Janice. This is quite an impressive room, I must say. good afternoon, everyone. My name is Christine Willett. I have to say admit that actually this is my first time at a newcomer session in 3 years. Russ and I both started 3 years ago, and we've been a bit preoccupied with the new GTLD program for much of these past 3 years. So I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to come to the newcomer session and talk about the Global Domains Division and the DNS industry and how we fit into the bigger ICANN picture today. This slide depicts, it's one of the common threads, I think, of your presentation today, and the portion of this multi-stakeholder model that the Global Domains Division works with largely are our contracted parties, the registries and registrars within the ICANN community. That's who we focus on. Now, what is it that the Global Domains Division does? We engage with the internet community in order to implement policies which have been adopted by the board through the policy development process, and those policies are frequently implemented through our contracts and through the services which we provide both to the internet community, the public, and to our contracted parties themselves. Our purpose, our mission, is really to serve the global public interest as well as the interests of the end users of the internet and registrants. We do that by ensuring that there is a stable and secure domain name system, and which also promotes choice, trust, and competition. So, I didn't realize this was a build slide. The stakeholders of the DNS are many. We start with the internet, and it's cute. The end user of the internet, the registrants who have registered domain names, interacting with the domain name system. We have our registry operators and our service providers, the registrars who we go to register domain names, the shared registration system, and EPP. So these are the various stakeholders within the domain name system. The way we interact with those players, here you see ICANN at the far left of this picture, and we really implement, as I said, the policies that the multi-stakeholder community adopts through our contracts with the registries and registrars. And you'll see at the top and at the bottom, there are really only two key contracts that ICANN has with Immunity. The registry agreement that we have with registry operators, those folks who operate top-level domains, and the registrar accreditation agreement, the agreement we have with the registrars. All of the other agreements you see are the agreements between other parties within the domain name system. The registrars have registrant agreements with registrants. The registries and registrars have RRAs, agreements between themselves. There are reseller agreements. There's registrant agreements. So that's those are not ICANN agreements. We do not manage them. We do not enforce those other agreements, but they are subject to the policies of ICANN. The part of the area of the Global Domains Division that I'm quite familiar with is the new GTLD program. Prior to 2013, there were, you'll see here the list of top-level domains that were in existence. The 8 original top-level domains that were delegated prior to the creation of ICANN, COM, EDU, Gov, etc. There were 2 previous rounds in which new GTLDs, new top-level domains were introduced, one in 2000 and one in 2004. Then ICANN embarked with the community on the process of developing policy around introduction of new GTLDs. So that occurred between 2005 and 2007. Then there was a policy implementation or design process. The result of that nearly 5 years of work resulted in what we called the applicant guidebook for the new GTLD program. It includes all of the rules around application processing, application submission, what the requirements are for being a new registry operator under the program. And the guidebook was adopted in 2011, and the application period began in January 2012. So we're now we've been in this implementation phase for the new GTLD program since January 2012. We accepted applications between January and May of 2012. We have been processing and evaluating those applications, and we began delegating. The first top-level domains were delegated into the root on 23 October 2013. So this week will be 2 years since the first top-level domain was delegated under the new GTLD program. The policy behind the new GTLD program also provided for the potential for additional future rounds for the new GTLD program. Here's a view of some of the statistics on the new GTLD program. When we opened the round, we received a total of 1,930 applications for new top-level domains, with nearly 1,300 unique strings applied for. This slide depicts where we stand as of, 2 weeks ago, Russ?
I think it's month end.
Month end, at the end of September. We had delegated 751 top-level domains, and we've contracted we've contracted 1,200 new top-level domain, signed 1,200 registry agreements under the program. It was always intended. Many people, many applicants applied for the same string. There was much contention. That's what led largely to the number of withdrawals that you have on the left-hand side of the screen, the 551 withdrawn to date, and we, based on the number of unique strings remaining to contract, we expect that 117 more will withdraw their application. This depicts where you see the top-level domains, which have been delegated to date, distributed around the world. It's rather clear that there is a disproportionate volume of top-level domains in North America and Europe. Latin America and Africa are clearly behind from the number of top-level domains delegated, and that was really also reflected in the application pool. there's been much discussion. Many aspects of the program are being reviewed, and I'll talk about that in a minute. And there's been much discussion about how, for future rounds, more interest, more applications can be generated from those regions of the world to better represent those areas. So the program review is underway. There are a number of them. Rights protection, I'm not quite sure if what all the topics you've already discussed today. But rights protection for refers to the interests of IP or intellectual property interests, trademark holders, other interests. So that was a very sensitive topic when the new GTLD program was launched. There was quite a bit of concern that rights would not be infringed upon, that there would not be a huge spike in squatting on domain names and in rights infringement. So the program implemented a number of rights protection mechanisms from the our URS program to our trademark clearinghouse. So all of those aspects of the program are being reviewed. The CCT metrics, that's our acronym for the competition, choice, and trust metrics, where that's actually two studies, one that was completed several months ago and one that will complete a year later, to look at how new GTLDs have affected competition, choice, and trust. There's a program implementation review that's currently out for public comment that Russ led, that the new GTLD program team led, and it reviews our implementation and our assessment of the operational implementation of the program, looking at how that aligned with the policy and the implementation advice or the applicant guidebook as the program was defined. Root stability study that is getting ready to kick off, that will be looking at how the new GTLD program has affected the stability of our root zone. There isn't an independent review on the trademark clearinghouse that I don't think is underway yet, but that was requested by the governmental advisory committee specifically, so we'll be producing that review for them. And then our affirmation of commitments actually calls for an overall CCT review. So these other reviews really feed and provide information to the overall CCT review, which is called for under our affirmation of commitments. That's actually just getting underway, and there's an open call for volunteers. So we're soliciting participants in that. This gives you an idea of the timeline. There's a lot of concurrent work going on these reviews. Much of it started back in 2014. You see in 2015, quite a bit is underway. We do not expect these reviews to finish until 2017. And recently, the board passed a resolution that shared their perspective that these reviews need to complete before we consider, before they consider a next round. So these reviews were committed to through various mechanisms, requests from the GAC, as I mentioned, from our affirmation of commitments, as well as part of the policy within the new GTLD program. So if you are wondering, I mentioned that the program, the policy that was adopted, called for subsequent rounds. But given that these reviews are going to go on for another nearly 2 years, I would not expect to see the next round open until these reviews are complete. Also underway, between this round and the next round, the GNSO is also looking at, they've done their own analysis of the program, and they have an issue report that is currently open for public comment. They had a large discussion group going for several months that contributed to that issue report, and they'll be likely kicking off, potentially kicking off, policy development work based on that issue report. And there's also work underway for an issue report on rights protection mechanisms as well. So there could be change between this round of the new GTLE program and the next round based on all of these reviews and all of the policy development work underway and expected. So I think Rob just talked to you about the policy development process. This slide talks about the implementation. And as I said, the Global Domains Division, GDD, our job begins sort of where the policy team's job ends. You know, once the board approves the policy recommendations, we go through a process of planning our work, analyzing how to do that, multi-stage, where we're engaged with the community, we're setting up timelines. From the point we get policy and the board adopts policy, we don't jump right into implementation. It could be a many month or even many year process until we deploy and support that policy. IDNs, or internationalized domain names. This is another aspect of the new GTLD program. Will Nayela be talking about this one? Okay. There are so many other people more qualified than myself to talk about internationalized domain names. Historically, if you look back several years, the only top-level domains were available were limited to a Latin script, the A to Z characters, so the .com, .org, as well as ccTLDs in Latin script. However, today we have IDN top-level domains in multiple scripts, Arabic, Chinese, Cyrillic, both in ccTLDs, as well as we have now, under the new GTLD program, delegated generic top-level domains in multiple scripts. Do you know off the top of your head, Russ, how many scripts we're currently supporting?
10 or so.
Yeah, I think we're probably at least had applications for top-level domains in more than 10 scripts. There's also ongoing work to develop the label generation rule sets. I don't know how to talk about this without using acronyms. Do you want to talk?
So the work ongoing right now in the IDN world is they're trying to develop kind of a master set of characters that can be used for top-level domains, and then dividing those into each script's kind of master set. So for Latin, for example, only A to Z and digits or something, as opposed to hashtags and exclamation points and things like that. So there's a lot of work in the community for each script community to develop their master set, and then that will feed into kind of a top-level master set. And then the idea is that'll help produce some standardization as to how new top-level domains could be formed in the future.
Thanks, Russ. You know, this is an area where we have a lot of linguists involved, a lot of language experts involved participating, but it's also an area where we're always in need of more volunteers. So if you yourself or you know of someone who has expertise in the scripts of your language that might be able to participate in these groups, there's a volunteer email location to volunteer here, but there are a number of ongoing sessions throughout the week covering these label generation rule sets, the work of these groups. So this would be a wonderful way to begin getting involved at ICANN. So that is where the presentation about the Global Domains Division ends. I don't know if you've got, I've got a few more minutes, if there's any questions.
Sure. If anyone has any questions, a microphone, Toussaint, back here. And Christine or Russ, are there any sessions coming up that you think might be beneficial for those newer? And again, the folks here aren't all people who have no idea at all about ICANN. They're engaged at some level and are looking for more information now that they're here face-to-face. But if there's anything that you can think of, maybe a session coming up.
Thank you. Akram Atala, the president of the Global Domains Division, will be giving an update tomorrow afternoon, I believe it's at 1 p.m., on everything that the Global Domains Division is doing and our work, all of the policy implementation work that's ongoing. Then we have, I want to say, we have a total of four sessions talking about the program implementation reviews. There's a session at 2:30 tomorrow that covers, it's an overview. Karen Lentz is leading. She's in charge of overseeing all of the review work. So she will be leading that with support from all of the different review teams. And then tomorrow afternoon, 5 o'clock, we will, my team and I will be talking about the specific program implementation review report, which we did on the new GTLD program. So, but I think all in all, the Global Domains Division has over 19 sessions this week on technical sessions. Policy, go ahead.
I think a lot of those sessions are about that implementation phase of the policy. So coming out, policies have been approved, as we talked about, and now the Global Domains Division team is working with the community to try and sharpen the details on how to implement those policies. So those are, if there's a particular one of interest to you, those are interesting sessions to participate in.
Hello, my name is Hansa. I'm from Sudan. On some slide, you talk about rights protection. So I want to know if some organization or individual request for domain, and for some reason, he discovered that this domain is owned by another entity. So what happened in this case, and how to prevent this not happening from the beginning? You understand my question?
So, thank you. Let me see if I understood the question. Your question is about an individual is interested in registering a domain name at the second level, not at the top level. And when they go to their registrar, they find that it's already registered to someone else. So what would they do in that case? Yes. So twofold, my answer would be twofold. First of all, the new GTLD program, as I said, is about competition, choice, and trust. So rather than being limited to the 22 top-level domains we had just 2 years ago, we now have over 700 top-level domains. So that second-level domain, my name is Christine Ouellette. So ChristineOuellette.com, I believe, is already registered. But I could go to ChristineOuellette.email or ChristineOuellette.ceo. So there are now so many new top-level domains, I could choose to register the name that I'm interested in, to brand myself. However, the other aspect of the question may be that you feel someone is infringing on your rights. So if you have a trademark in a certain name, we have... that's where our rights protection mechanisms come in. We have I'm happy to talk about if there's a specific concern, how best to handle that. But we have several mechanisms, as I said, within the new GTLD program. Again, I'm going to talk in acronyms. I apologize. But we have mechanisms to dispute that registration if you feel that someone is infringing on your rights. And those are, our compliance team can help you through that. We also operate a customer service, a global support team. So you can also email us if you have a concern specifically, customerservice@icann.org, if there's a specific question. But there are multiple ways to assert your rights and to challenge a party that you think is infringing on those rights.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Matogoro Jabera from Tanzania. I'm a newcomer. I'm interested with the statistic on slide number 61. I see only 3 GTLD in Africa. So my question is, why few GTLD have been received so far from Africa? What should be a message back to my community, possibly on opportunities for new GTLD? Thank you.
Yes, you're right. There are relatively few top-level domains operated in Africa. We would love to see more. We're talking very much in the reviews. We're looking at how can we generate more awareness throughout Africa and other regions of the world to develop greater interest as we look ahead to the next round for new GTLDs. I was not here before the program began, but my understanding is that there were efforts made to raise awareness of the new GTLD program, but clearly we need to do more. We need to look at other ways that we can raise awareness and support applicants from parts of the world who are not well represented today.
Hello, thank you very much. My name is Annika. I'm from Germany. Actually, I've got 2 questions. So the first one is, are there going to be any limitations about how many new GTLDs are going to be implemented? Or could it be that we have .fish, .cow, .pig, .animals, .whatever you can imagine? So this will be the first question. And the second one is, how do you decide about the actual names? I mean, there are people applying for, I'm making this up, for instance, for .farm, .farmers, and .farming. How do you decide which GTLD will be implemented?
Both very good questions. So in the round that we were referring to, the round that kicked off in 2012, there were very few restrictions, actually. We had planned for about 500 applications and received almost 2,000 applications, as Christine mentioned earlier, and received of those 2,000, there were about 1,300-ish unique strings. So there was a lot of overlap. People had applied for the same thing or something, as you alluded to in your second question, is potentially confusing. Again, in this round, the community agreed in the creation of the guidebook, the rules for the round, to define only very specific reasons why not to allow applications based on their string. So they set the standard as to it had to be visually confusing with each other. So in this round, we ended up with a fair amount of car and cars, auto and autos, shop and shopping, I think it's going to be a free market determination as to what GTLDs are more successful than others or maybe even last longer than others. That's probably something that'll be discussed quite a bit in the policy review time that we're coming into about what should be the rules if we do this again. Should we foresee those types of situations, and are we okay with it as a community, or do we want to restrict it further?
Hey, I want to thank the two of you. If there are any other questions, we do need to move to our next speakers. I know Christine has an obligation. Russ is here. I'm sure he wouldn't mind at all kind of walking back this way and having a chat with you on his way out. If you wouldn't mind that at all. I want to thank you both very much. Excellent. And 1 second, Russ, there is a Global Domain Divisions booth. Is there a place that someone could come for information, or should they come? Okay.
Yeah, there is a booth. I believe it's towards the entrance of the convention center. Probably says GDD, Global Domains Division. Feel free to stop by. There should be people there most of the day, most every day. Introduce yourselves and ask questions, get materials, and everyone's very helpful and should be happy to see you.
Thank you. Grace and Ayala, if you'd like to come up, we can see we're skipping back and forth here just a little bit, but Nayela, you can take the handheld mic if you'd like and be comfy. Navid has one here for you, and Nayela is going to talk a bit about the ANA function, and then Grace is going to share some information about the hot topic of this conference, which is the IANA transition and accountability. So take it away.
Thanks, Janice. And thank you all for your time today. It's always fun to come talk in this session. I'd say this is probably the best part of the week for us, especially as IANA staff. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. I'm Naila Saras. I'm the IANA Services Manager at ICANN. I've worked in the IANA department. I've been with ICANN for 10 years, and I started out in the IANA department. Went a little bit to do IDNs. That's why Christine was trying to get me to talk about IDNs, but I will refrain. And then now I'm back in IANA as the services manager. You didn't give me the clicker. Oh, you're going to click it for me? Perfect. No, it's okay. You can click for me. Okay. So I heard Rob and a little bit of Christine talk enough about the policy development process that brings us to implementation in ICANN. And the IANA department is just another arm where the multi-stakeholder is raising, agreeing policies and sending them to IANA for implementation. And so I'll be talking from that angle. But before we go into that, let's do a little bit of history. So IANA, I keep saying using the acronym, I'm assuming everyone is familiar with it. This is the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. A little bit of history, that the term IANA goes back to, I think, early references go back to the early 70s, early 70s. And I'm told I've never seen it. The gentleman that looked after the IANA functions before they were transferred to ICANN was Mr. John Postel, and Mr. Postel had a notebook where he recorded the different assignments or allocations that he made, and that's the function that was transferred into ICANN in the 1990s when the internet thing took off. What we do in IANA is we basically maintain registries. They add up to thousands of registries. Most of those registries are in the protocol parameters area. We do the three main functions are the protocol parameters, number resources, and domain names. And we'll go specifically into each one of those. We, as Rob said, we maintain these in accordance with policies agreed by the community. Let's click to the next session. Okay, so because the internet isn't complete anarchy, there needs to be one centralized body that maintains authoritative lists, if you will, so that you can go to one place and look up port numbers and know what port number 80 is doing. If you come up with a genius idea and you want to register your own port number, you send that request to IANA, and upon approval, you can start using that port number. So what we do for these registries, in protocol parameters, we work in coordination with the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. And in the protocol parameters, we basically really just have thousands and thousands of registries. If you go into the IANA website, you can access all those registries. I looked at the page, and there's multiple pages. If you just say, show me the registries, there's multiple pages where those registries show up. Those registries are pretty straightforward, and they're basically registries of ports, of names and numbers of protocol parameters. So that's the work that we do with the IETF mainly, in coordination with the IETF.
The number resources, as the name implies, is the allocation of IPv4, IPv6, and ASN numbers. The IANA allocates those numbers to the five regional internet registries, RIRs, around the world. And then the RIRs turn around and then further allocate those resources to their customers. So here you can see it's a hierarchy. We hold the resource, we allocate it to five regional internet registries, and then they further allocate it down, etc. The third area is the domain names area. That's where probably where you see the most visibility into IANA's work. That's the maintenance of the root zone, the DNS. And in that work, we are doing allocation of new TLDs as well as maintenance of existing TLDs. Until 3 years ago, maybe, we had roughly 300 TLDs in the root zone, and the majority of those were country code top-level domains. So the bulk of our work was basically routine requests for top-level domains. So what does that mean? Let's say we're here in Ireland, so .ie for Ireland wants to make a change to their top-level domain, whether it's a technical change where they want to change the details about their top-level domain in the root zone, or what we call a social data change, where they want to change the whois information or the contact information for .ie. They would lodge a request and send it to IANA, and IANA staff process that request in accordance with CCNSO policy and policies and community agreed policies. And eventually, when we finish processing the request, we transmit it onto what we call the root zone partners, the NTIA and VeriSign. And once it's approved by VeriSign, once it's approved by NTIA, VeriSign implements it in the root zone. So that was the bulk of our work up until 3 years ago. Then the new GTLD program was started, and my colleagues Christine and Rod talked a lot about that. So then now the bulk of our work, really, I mean, we still do all the routine requests for the CCTLDs and the GTLDs. We're also processing many, many requests for the delegation of new GTLDs. So the community did their work to come up with the policy for new GTLDs. It went up to Christine's team. They did all the evaluations to decide which GTLD application was ready for implementation in the root zone. And when that work is done, then it's passed on to IANA. And then our work is to take that request, again, verify it against all the agreed policies. And when that work is completed, we send it to be added to the root zone. We are, I think I heard her say we have up close to 700 delegated TLDs, new GTLDs now. A little bit more, yeah. So which is true, because we're a little bit over 1,000 right now. So that work keeps us busy. So I spent a lot of time telling you about the new GTLDs and our work there, because I think that's probably the most visible part of our work. And if you have any questions on that or any of the other areas, if I didn't cover them enough, please let me know. I mentioned earlier that I said each request that we work on goes to NTIA for authorization, and then VeriSign for implementation in the root zone, because those are our what we call the root zone partners. This all happens because we do the work that we do under a contract between ICANN and the U.S. government. I used NTIA here. We're talking about NTIA is the department within the U.S. government that does this work with us. But that's where the contract is. And I think with that, I'm going to pass the mic on to my colleague, Grace, and afterwards I'll be available for any questions.
So that, because I think I'm going to have to switch between. Sorry about that. I should have come up. I can. Hi, everyone. So my name is Grace Abu Hamid. I work with the Strategic Initiatives Department, which is the department that's sort of responsible for ICANN's evolution. And it's an exciting department to be in, and I'm going to talk to you about probably the most exciting project at ICANN
and maybe an internet history. And I might be exaggerating, but it's worth it to get your attention. So we're going to talk about the IANA stewardship transition, which Nayela sort of briefly touched upon what IANA does. And when we talk about the stewardship transition, we're talking about the contract with the U.S. government potentially, they've announced that they're willing to transition their perceived, you know, their oversight and their authorization role of IANA to the global internet community. And to do that, they need a proposal from the global internet community, so from ICANN, from the customers involved with the IANA operations, to prove that we're ready to do this. We're ready to oversee it ourselves. And this is what the IANA stewardship transition is about, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and then there's a related project I'll talk to you about afterwards. So in announcing the transition, the U.S. government came out with some criteria, and they said, okay, you global internet community, you can handle the oversight of the IANA functions, but you have to give us a proposal that meets these requirements. And there are four requirements. They're very important. Then there's a fifth one on the bottom of the slide that says that the U.S. government will not accept a proposal that basically replaces their role with another government or intergovernmental role, because the idea here is to get away from focusing on one stakeholder's oversight and to broaden it to the multi-stakeholder oversight, right? So you can take a look at these. You're going to see these slides a lot this week, and you'll see them a lot at ICANN in general for the past 2 years. This has been a big, big focus of ours, so I won't spend too much time on these, but these are the four criteria and the fifth one that's also key to the transition. Linked to the IANA stewardship transition, there is another process that was launched, and that is a process to enhance ICANN's role and ICANN's accountability as a result of the U.S. government's stepping back, right? And that's because the idea here is the organization is going to have to evolve. If there's the U.S. government was, ICANN was in contract with the U.S. government for a long time. Without the U.S. government involved, there's going to have to be evolution for the organization, for the global community, and for the organization. So there's step one is the first process is really about the operational side of things. How will the contract, the role in the contract, be replaced from an operational perspective? And the second project is about how ICANN as an organization can grow and evolve in light of the transition. So this is a very complicated graphic, but it shows you how many different parts of the community are involved in this. So we have for the first project, the ICG, which is the IANA Coordination Group. And they're basically a group of about 30 people representing different groups in the internet community, governments, CCTLDs, GTLDs, civil society, et cetera. IANA customers, basically, for this project. They have a role in overseeing the transition. And they've asked the three customers of the IANA services to give them proposals on their specific part of IANA. And Nayela explained earlier, there are three parts. There's the names, which is the CWG Stewardship Group. There's the numbers, and that's the CRISP group. And then there's the protocol parameters, and that's the IANA plan group. And each one of those groups are going to develop a piece about their specific registry, and they're going to pose that, and then the ICG's job is to combine them all together. So that launched about, July of 2014. The announcement was made in March, and the ICG launched in July, and they came out with a request for these different proposals in September of 2014. And the groups have been working really hard on all of these projects, and I think the next slide, yes, so here, this slide shows you when each one of the groups delivered their proposal. So there were different time frames, different levels of complication for the proposals and different groups involved, and that shows you kind of the diversity of the community. But we've had all three are now submitted, and the ICG is working on compiling those. Has actually already put together a proposal, and at the ICANN meeting this week, they're going through that proposal, finalizing it, and getting it ready for submission. So I'll go back to this graphic for a second, because the second part of the chart on the bottom is that second process I talked to you about, the one about evolving ICANN as an organization. and that's the CCWG Accountability. And that group is also a broad community group within ICANN. All the different SOs and ACs that Rob talked to you about earlier are represented in this group. And their job is to develop a proposal that evolves ICANN as an organization. And their focus, they have a dual focus, but their focus in this context is what is needed with the U.S. government's role stepping out of the contract role, right? What is needed to replace oversight there? There's a perceived oversight, there's an authorization role. What is needed to replace that, and what does the community want to do to evolve in that context? Both of those proposals there's already two drafts of the second of the CCWG's proposal, and both of those proposals are being discussed this week at ICANN. So it's a very exciting time to be here, because the next step is a submission to the ICANN board, and after that, submission to the U.S. government, and hopefully after that, a successful transition. So we are at very exciting times. I will go into accountability now and explain a little bit more about what the group there is doing. So we talked about this earlier. The transition in the accountability side is about sort of evolving the organization in the context of removing the U.S. contractual role. The interesting thing about this is ICANN has already evolved as an organization over the past 15 years. We've had to put together lots of different accountability mechanisms for the organization. And so there are many that exist already. And the part of this process is looking at evolving those where needed and also building on what we already have and adding some where we need to, right? So this is just an example listing of all the things that we already have within ICANN. There are two parts of the accountability project, right? It's a big group that's involved in this, and it's an open group, so anyone can join, and the group grows every day. We have new members and new participants joining. What they're working on is a project in two phases. The first phase, called Workstream 1, is specifically about the IANA transition, things that have to happen and are linked to the first project that I talked about. And the second one is about evolving the organization more broadly, accountability more broadly for ICANN. And some examples of those are on the next slide. Here you go. Some examples of those are on this slide. And basically, in removing the contractual role that the U.S. government had, one of the things that the community is looking at is having stronger ties between ICANN and the community, stronger role there. So some of that means revising the mission, the core values, the commitment, some of the governing documents of ICANN to ensure there's continued strong ties between the community and the organization. There's also, you know, what do you do when a decision is made and you don't agree with that decision, something like that. So there's stronger appeals processes, appeals mechanisms. So they're enhancing those and working on those parts of the accountability framework. There's an existing agreement with the U.S. government today. It's called the Affirmation of Commitments. That is ICANN's commitment to accountability and to reviewing and evolving as an organization. That agreement today exists as a separate document that ICANN has with the U.S. government. One of the things that the group is looking at today is to take that agreement and put it into the governing documents of ICANN, sort of guaranteeing that ICANN will always be evolving its structure and reviewing its different commitments to the community. So I'm going to jump back to the other slide for a minute. The CCWG, this CCWG, I should clarify, that stands for Cross Community Working Group, and it's just a term we use at ICANN for groups that are broader than just one SO or AC. When different groups work together, they become a cross-community working group. So this cross-community working group on enhancing ICANN accountability is really in the process of putting together their proposal. And every day there are new updates, there are new things that are happening with this group. The group has put out a draft in June, and they put out another draft in August. And they're, as we speak, working on coming out with another set of recommendations or revised set of recommendations. So I won't go into too much of the detail of their proposal because you're going to hear about it a lot this week. And it's always changing. You're going to be able to participate in a lot of sessions. There's over 25 hours this week of work dedicated to this project. But one of the things that there are a few things that they're really already agreed to work on, and they have the principles and they're working on the details. They're working on the binding appeals, fixing the appeals mechanisms, and working on enhancing the current independent review process that ICANN has. They're also looking at putting together a series of community powers, things that the community will need in light of the transition. And those are outlined here. And like I said, the details are still being worked out, and you'll see them talk about these a lot this week. But when they refer to powers, these are the powers that they're talking about. And I'll go over them briefly. They want to be more involved in the discussions about the ICANN budget and where it goes and what is being approved as budget. And in linked to that is the budget for IANA operations. They want to make sure that IANA always has funding and can always do the basic technical functions for the Internet to make sure the Internet stays safe and operates properly, right? The next two are about the bylaws, ICANN's governing documents, and they want to make sure that those bylaws stay, you know, the content is, the important things are strongly protected, right, and that they can't be changed easily, and that things, when they change, would also have community input. So that includes the document I was talking to you about earlier, the affirmation of commitments, moving that into the bylaws, guaranteeing it for ICANN long-term and making it something that's very hard to change so that we guarantee that there will always be evolution for the organization. The last two are about the board of directors. And essentially what the group wants to do is they want to be able to remove a director in the case of non-compliance with the mission or something. So if for some reason they notice that the ICANN board of directors is going against the ICANN mission or not funding IANA or doing something that would harm the Internet, they want to be able to have a say in whether that board can remain in its seat. So that's the goal there with the powers to remove the board. They're also, the CCWG is part of its work is linked to the IANA stewardship transition. And so some of the things that the IANA stewardship project called out as things they needed are being addressed in this group. And there's a sort of a check and balance system. So the IANA transition group said, well, we need to make sure that we have oversight over the IANA budget. And the CCWG says, okay, we have a community power that's going to guarantee that. So those are the sort of, there's a lot of conversations going on between the two groups about that. And I think this is all I have for you today. So that's all I have. So I was going to go into a general encouragement for you to get engaged. We have three phases for this project. There's the part of the project that we're in right now is phase one. So you have where you can still get involved, and it's still a very exciting time to join. We're developing the proposals right now. So we're still in the phase of coming together as a community and putting getting the great minds together and putting together a really exciting and strong proposal for the future of ICANN and the Internet. Once we get through that phase, the proposals go to the U.S. government for review, and they're going to review those proposals based on their criteria that they outlined that I talked about at the beginning, the four criteria and the fifth one about intergovernment and government role. When they review the proposals and agree that the community has responded to their request, they're happy with the results. The goal, phase three, would be that they sign off on these proposals and that we go ahead and implement these changes. And this is a big, this would be a big change for the Internet and for ICANN. So it's a very exciting time and something that is worth you participating in and following. You can get engaged. If you have any questions, please come talk to me afterwards, and we can sign you up and get you engaged in the process. All right?
That's right. No, thank you, Grace. And I really appreciate your segue into engagement, because many times we hear after this session, when we talk about IANA, the last couple meetings and the transition, it sounds like, oh, it's already complete. You know, why would I, you know, become engaged at this point? And I think you did a really good job explaining that. And the fact is, with this work is ongoing. The work of ICANN's ongoing. There's never a time to say it's too late, it's too early. You know, it's not just that right time. We're looking for fresh minds always. We're all old and tired. I've got gray hair back here, and I frankly don't know enough. That's why I get to do this day, so I can sit here and learn more each time. And I truly do. But there's never the right time, the wrong time. It's all the time. Because this is going to continue. Even when, you know, we're crossing our fingers, the board approves, and we get ready to move on, if we're talking specifically accountability and IANA transition, there's still work to do beyond that. And we, honestly, I wouldn't be here on this day, and all of the staff that have been here and community members today wouldn't be here if we didn't need you. And we need you to understand more. Sometimes joining a working group is about listening and learning. It doesn't mean you have to take up the pen right away. Sometimes joining a mailing list is about learning. Just watching the emails come through, a policy update email, you know, once every 2 months, just start to learn that way. But join a phone call, join a conference call. You can stay silent on it and just learn. And we have email addresses to write to on very specific things, or just engagement at ICANN.org and say, I was listening to this conference call. Who would I go to for more information? So it's a learning experience all the time. And then when you get excited about something enough to the point that you say, hey, I'm ready to dive in, you know, we'll make sure that we've got the net there waiting, you know, to catch you when you dive and to bring you along. So I thank Nayela and Grace so much. This is so important for everyone for the rest of this week. 25 sessions, or what'd you say, 25 hours?
25 hours
of sessions about this. So it's really important that you start to build an understanding and an excitement about what this is. So as I asked Dave Piscatella to come up and take one of the mics, I just want to give an opportunity if anyone has any questions for either of these ladies right now.
Thank you for the two speeches. I'm Nabil and I'm from Morocco. I'm a second-time fellow in ICANN. My question is about IPv6. You have mentioned that the three main functions of IANA is the Internet IPv4, IPv6 addresses, and protocol numbers.
AS numbers
and protocol numbers.
So, protocol
numbers that we can find in the
/etc/protocols
in the Linux systems.
Okay.
So my question is related to IPv6. Why we can't see a great engagement and from IANA to IPv6 deployments? When it comes to IPv6, we can see that a lot of organizations are talking about this move to IPv6 migration, like ISOC, like IETF, like RIRs. But when it comes to ICANN, we can't see a lot of IPv6 speeches. So it's not a hot topic in ICANN meetings or from IANA side. Can you explain more a little bit about this point?
Thank you. Yeah, thank you for your question. So I'm going to speak about this from the perspective of the IANA department, not as much from ICANN. So you're right. The uptake is it's a hard conversion, and it requires work and upgrades of systems and investment, etc. You're asking why don't you hear more from IANA? So the reason why you don't hear from us IANA staff about this is the IANA function, what we do is very administrative work. We're maintainers of registries. The work, it's really interesting because right now I'm in the process of hiring some people in my department. And, you know, the work is amazing and very technical. in its implementation, but to actually, but IANA itself, we're not out there installing IPv6 networks or even promoting them. We're allocating resources to RIRs who are turning around and allocating them to their customers. So it's really not IANA's and the IANA function's place to be advocating IPv6. That said, I think someone else from my colleagues maybe could speak to this. I don't know if Dave is a good person, because there used to be workshops in ICANN where I think there'd be at least one topic on IPv6 and that. Right. Yeah, so if you could go ahead.
Hi, I'm Dave Piscatella. I'm the Vice President of Security and ICT Coordination at ICANN. Before I came to ICANN, I was actually in the IETF. I was in the IESG. How many of you know these acronyms? I don't know what you've covered so far. You haven't covered IETF? Or, yeah. So the IETF is the Internet Engineering Task Force. And like ICANN, it's one of the I's, along with Internet Society. And it is the group that that is the most technical of the three of our organizations. And they are the people who have designed the protocols, who essentially designed IP version 6 as the replacement for version 4, designed the addressing scheme, and then created the standards that we are all using now. When I was there, part of the process where we chose IPv6, and in fact, I was the loser. One of the protocols that I had written didn't get approved, so I'm very bitter. And
Dave, take a breath. The interpreters.
Oh, interpreters! I didn't realize we were interpreting. Sorry. I thought we were in an English-speaking country. No, I'm joking. So one of the things that that we observed, even at the time when we were writing this protocol, was that there has always been a very, very difficult process of moving the installed base to do anything new. And the reasons are often it's an expensive transition in terms of just the sheer hardware. It's also a very, very steep learning curve. And many organizations don't actually feel the incentive to do so. I don't think any of us in 1995 even imagined in our worst dreams that we would be only at about 6 or 7% deployment of IPv6 currently. And all our worries about the power of the installed base have really come to fruition, because lots of the organizations that we need to migrate to IPv6 in order to have the content present on IPv6 to attract the internet service providers to provide IPv6 addresses to their consumers is absent. If you go and you look at the top 1,000 websites, even today, you still will not find more than 20% of the top 1,000 websites running on IPv6 infrastructures. So no matter what ICANN might do or the individual regional internet registries might do to promote the adoption of IP version 6, comes down to economics, and it comes down to getting the willingness and will for a lot of the what we would consider merchant infrastructure, so to speak, to say, yes, we're going to move that new platform. When it becomes economically feasible for them, or when they simply can't use IPv4 addresses anymore because they are not available in their new locations or new areas in the world where they want to penetrate, I think that's when you're going to see a fairly steep rise in the curve.
Thank you, Dave.
Was there one more question? I wasn't sure. Okay.
Hi. I am Manuel from NIC Mexico. Actually, I wanted to know, how is the stewardship, the overall supervision from the NTIA lived on a day-to-day basis? Actually, I made this question to Elise Gehrig a year ago, and he told me that there was this kind of window with accept and cancel,
yes,
that a certain functionary from the NTIA did every 3 days or something like that.
Yes.
I just wanted to know a little bit, how is it lived on a day-to-day basis by the people in the U.S. government?
Okay, so I can't speak for how is it done by people in the U.S. government, but I can tell you from my perspective. So I'm one of the people that are actually sitting there. My team is working on these requests that are coming in. And when we finish our internal processing, we all have something called the root zone management system. The IANA department has its portion of it, the NTIA has a little portion, and then VeriSign has their portion of this root zone management system. So when we finish our processing, just like Elise said, we finish it, we said, okay, it's ready, we transmit it, and it goes. It does this like fork thing. It at the same time, it goes to the two entities, the two root zone partners. NTIA is one, and VeriSign is another. VeriSign sees it, sits on it. It actually is transferred to VeriSign through the EPP through an EPP request. But they sit on the request until NTIA really truly logs into their interface, which is just one screen, and it has accept or don't accept, I guess. I don't know what the other option is because they've never not accepted. So I assume there's only an accept button. But really, in all seriousness, it's a window they bring up. They authorize the requests, and then that's VeriSign's clue to go ahead and implement the request. As I said, I've been with ICANN for 10 years. I don't know of one incident where they didn't authorize. Some of our colleagues that we work with are here at this meeting. I've heard them characterize this. They spend minutes on this work a day. It's not heavy lifting at all what they do for us. From the day-to-day you're asking about, it's almost, to me, that's not the bulk of the process at all. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, my question is also related to the number community. You mentioned that you delegate on the five rears all numbers so that they can redistribute them to the community. I know that in two of those rears, APNIC and LACNIC, they used to have what they call NIRs, National Internet Registries, where they push down the control to those NIRs. Does ICANN have something to do with these NIRs to be defined, to be rejected, or ICANN is completely apart from them and is the rear who decide where a NIR is applied or where they couldn't be created?
So it's the latter. ICANN doesn't decide how the RIRs, each RIR run their business. So this is, it's not, ICANN isn't involved in how each RIR implements their operations. That said, it's the RIRs, ICANN is only implementing agreed policy. And so it's the RIRs that get together and decide what's called global policy, send it to ICANN, and ICANN implements it. But we're not creating policy and sending it back to the RIRs to implement in their business. That is not the case.
And in our efforts to get us here on time, I'm going to say thank you very much. As Grace said, there are many opportunities, including this afternoon at 4:45 right here, to talk more about the IANA transition and accountability. And Nayela and her team are here as well all week for any questions about the IANA functions further to that. If you need to find Grace or Nayela or any of the staff, you can stop at the ICANN information booth, which is managed by the fellowship program, and ask them, let them know who it is you're trying to get a hold of, and we will make our very best effort because this is our time as staff to face-to-face meet with any of you. So if you can't chase these folks down in the hallways, just come to the information booth and we will make sure that we get you connected. Thank you very much.
Am I going the right way? Keep moving.
We kind of played with the structure today, Dave. So
okay, I'm going. This is not me. This is not me. I'm trying. Yeah, animations kill you when you're trying to go fast. Right. Okay.
They had a lot to say during that session. Yeah. And now the fun part starts. When Dave steps up, you know there's going to be fun.
Oh my gosh. Well, they've taken my nice, sexy, jazzed-up slides, and they put them on a on a standard template. Okay, who's this? Okay, I think I've introduced myself. Let me introduce my organization. I work with the Identifier System Security, Stability, and Resiliency team. We report to John Crane, who is the chief security officer. He reports to now David Conrad, who is the chief technology officer, who reports to the CEO, Fadi Shahadi. We are probably the smallest team at ICANN. There are one, two, three, four of us, and one half-time. Actually, he's a full-time employee who works 100% of the time for us and 100% of the time for global stakeholder engagements. We're a very, very different kind of team in ICANN. We are probably the most policy agnostic of the ICANN community. Even the IANA has more policy influence and contribution than we do. We have four areas of operation. We are not your traditional security team. We don't sit inside ICANN's operational network and watch for attacks and do mitigations and do all the planning for how ICANN would protect its website, for example. Having said that, because the people in our team have extensive experience in some of those skill sets, we're usually called in and we usually provide some technical or subject matter expertise in various projects that are going to be public-facing for ICANN, and we contribute to how ICANN defends its networks. The four areas that we operate are really very different and distinct. One is called threat awareness and preparedness. What we provide along with most of the major DNS operators, the registry operators, the registrars, pretty much the entire DNS community, almost anyone who actually provides some part of the DNS service, is a 24/7/365 intelligence gathering and response communication team, and cooperatively we engage in major threats and try to dismiss them. So as an example, a number of years ago, there was a distributed denial of service attack to try to disrupt one of the major root name servers. And we were part of the community that was trying to understand how we would, what is called, abate that attack or reduce the amount of traffic. That means that we have a fairly big contact list of people who are running internet service providers, running global DNS services, and we stay in constant communication with them. A few years ago, we had an attack or a threat that was never realized by the anonymous group. They were going to also attempt to try to attack the root name servers, and we invested a fair amount of time putting together what's called a red team. To go out, a red team is a team that tries to understand and penetrate and figure out whether you are vulnerable. And so we actually implemented a red team attack to make certain to see that we were resilient, and we were fairly confident, and we waited for the date that was supposed to be the attack. I think it was April 1st, and we weren't certain whether it was going to be just an April Fool's joke or whether it was going to be real. So as a responsible security team, we engaged in this as if it were going to be an attack. We spend a lot of time in our team, especially my CSO, John Crane, who has extensive operational experience, in going in and working with various CCTLDs and other operators to help them understand whether they have sufficient capacity to withstand attack, whether they're providing good performance to their countries. We also help some of the new TLDs and some of the traditional TLDs in those same areas. So let me flip past to the next slide here and see if I've actually told you what I told you I was going to say. This was all supposed to be black and in Courier, so I'm sorry. I think I've covered everything here. So one of the things that we have to actually do is pretty much the same kind of threat level assessment that you see when you go to an airport. Is this traffic light amber? Is this traffic light green? Is this traffic light red? Where are we in terms of worrying about threats? So one of the areas that sort of goes hand in hand with that is what we call trust-based collaboration. But in particular, much of our effort in trust-based collaboration focuses on trying to mitigate the exploitation of the DNS and of domain registrations for the purpose of conducting crime or putting up illicit content. We get involved with law enforcement and what we call security reporters or security interveners who try to assist in identifying botnets, identifying places where websites are being used to download malware. How many of you are familiar with the concept of ransomware? Yeah. So, we've been involved. Ransomware is a kind of infection on your computer where the criminal will actually encrypt your entire hard drive or all your critical files, and then you'll put up a message saying, if you don't pay me in 24 hours, you'll never get your data back. So not only is that a fairly nefarious thing to do, but in many cases what they would do is they would put up a symbol of a police agency. And so clearly the police called us. We got involved in this, and we actually were part of a fairly broad scoped, very large community of people who were all trying to actively dismantle what was called the Game Over Zeus botnet, and this was responsible for a lot of that kind of ransomware. So our jobs are very exciting in some respects because we work with active threats. We work with a community that is quite honestly astonishingly smart. I always get angry when I hear talk about elite hackers and how bright they are. The truth is that there are only about 100 elite hackers in the world. The rest of them are all people who borrow and beg and steal from those guys. Right. Again, there's sort of a complementing flow of what we do. Because we're involved in that whole threat world and because we're involved in the trust-based collaboration, often people will come to us and say, gee, you seem to know something about this. Can you teach us? And so 10 years ago, John put together a program that it began as training a couple of CCTLDs on how to actually build their registry. This was when some of the CCTLDs didn't even have a registry yet. There were, that country was not standing up its own internet. And from that modest beginning, we now have a fairly extensive training course where we can go in and we can either directly from our staff or teamed with some of our technical partners who are good trainers, we can go to a country. We can help them understand how to deploy secure registry operations. We can assist in incidents and response. We can help them by teaching them how to build incident response plans, build capacity. And from that, we also ended up spending more time talking with law enforcement and with what we call the public safety community, which is not only law enforcement, but prosecutors and jurists and the like. And we have a training component now where we help investigators learn how to look at the DNS and the address aspects of a criminal activity and how to go and find where the content is being hosted, who is hosting it, what the website looks like. We show them how to do this in relative anonymity so that they aren't leaving crumbs and a trail for the criminals to actually detect and see that they're being observed. That's a growing part of our training program. I frankly find it the most exciting part. It's a really, really interesting engagement. It's not quite like CSI Miami, but it's still very, very interesting. The last thing that we are involved in, and this is sort of a nascent or birthing part of this program, is trying to understand the nature of abuse, how domain names and addresses are being used by criminals, where they're getting that asset or that resource, because in fact, a name is part of a criminal's toolkit. One of the most important things that we teach when we go and we talk to law enforcement is that the nexus or the intersection point of legitimate use of the internet and criminal abuse of the internet is the domain name, because it's the way that You know, the way that criminals lure you to a website through a phishing attack. It's the way that they are able to send spam without it being immediately blocked when it comes into the system. So by allowing us to, by the criminals using domain names, what that allows us to do is start to work on how they got them, where they got them, why are they getting them from this particular registrar? Why are they using this particular registry? What behaviors, or what we call flocking behavior in statistics, are we observing? So we're just beginning to put together some programs. A couple of us have been working on proof of concept or skunkworks projects that seem to have promise. So I'm hoping that maybe next time I come, I'll be able to talk more about what we're doing here and maybe show you some statistics and kind of show you some of the things that we've actually been identifying. I think that is basically all I had intended to say. I'm happy to answer questions about any of the four areas that we operate in. So thank you very much for having me.
Any questions for our good friend? I see a hand up back here.
Hey, thank you. Good afternoon to you. I'm Gilbert from Seychelles. Just wanted to ask a question regarding the last comments you made about being able to track the origin of the user. We're seeing a lot of terrorist actions like ISIS posting websites, uploading YouTube videos and all that. Is there any way of tracking that, tracking it back to the IP address and knowing the location?
It's very interesting that you said that, because earlier on my trip to Dublin, I actually did training for an organization that is investigating radicalization, recruitment, and terrorist sites. And a short answer for you is yes, we can. And we can, while the criminals try to hide those, hide where they do that, and they move information around quite a bit, we can track them. The biggest problem that we have in almost all circumstances with all content, it doesn't really matter whether it's terrorist site or a human trafficking site or a child abuse site, is that outside of child abuse, which is generally abhorred all over the world and you can almost always get a local court order, often things that that fall into the realm of what we call terrorism isn't necessarily considered terrorism in the jurisdiction where the content is actually hosted. Sometimes it is, but there are parties who quite honestly make their living hosting content where they claim to be bulletproof. What they will do is they will advertise in the criminal underground as saying, we guarantee you for the $200 you're going to pay us, for the 24 hours that you're going to get for the $200, that we will ignore court orders, we will not let anyone in our room, we will not let anyone disrupt your service. When faced with that kind of adversarial situation, it's very, very challenging. Often what we encounter is a situation where one country will find the content, and they'll go and they'll ask either the registrar or the registry to take down the content. And if that registry and registrar is not in the same jurisdiction, and they're reticent to take something down that's going to get them involved in either some sort of notoriety on a public website or blog, or attract the unwanted attention reaction from a hostile group, they may decline. The only recourse legally at that point is to do something called a mutual legal agreement treaty request, MLAT. If you just remember that term, because it's going to become much very, very important and prominent in policymaking in the next 3 to 5 years. An MLAT is something that a law enforcement agent has to prepare and go to a local jurisdiction or court. And it has to be approved, and it has to go across state departments. When it gets across state departments, it's delivered to another court. They have to review it and decide that they want or they agree, and then they will respect the MLAT and serve the local the local party, right? Yeah. Those don't happen in internet time. Those take weeks, months. Yeah, it's very frustrating. Now, if you only have one page in one jurisdiction, it takes a long time. When we have to do something like a global botnet dismantling that spans 6 country codes, 5 generic top-level domains, and what we want to do is seize all the domain names and stop them from resolving at the very same time, it's absolutely, you know, a nightmare in permutations and combinations of requests that you have to have served and ready. And one of the things that was remarkable about being involved in the Game Over Zeus was that, you know, right up until 45 minutes before we were actually going to pull on this, there was one attorney, you know, somewhere in the giant space of this, who was not going to cooperate. And it took a phone call, you know, from our team, quite literally, to our colleague of ours who was a CTO of that company, and said, "This is what's going to happen in now 43 minutes if you can't talk your attorney down from where he's standing." At, you know, T-minus 40, we got a call 3 minutes later saying, "Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand," from the attorney. And what it turned out to happen is that simultaneously all these court orders, you know, were served. There were seizures of equipment. There was apprehension of, you know, of alleged perpetrators. And the network just stopped. Right? It takes, you know, that was a 9-month effort in just putting together the court process, not collecting the evidence. Now, if you think about the ransomware that I was talking to you about, this was a enormously financially beneficial activity for the ransomware conspirators. They were making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. So every day that we were not able to take this down was, you know, inflicting harm and causing massive, you know, massive financial loss and misery. So it was really a day to celebrate, when we were actually part of that. So thank you.
Dave, I was just thinking one of the best things about Newcomers Day is the enthusiasm and passion that the speakers have, like yourself. One of the worst things is like, what is he talking about? No, but it is. And what I want to say here is that Dave and some of his peers will be coming to see the fellows on Wednesday at 5:30 in Liffey B. So if you'd like to, and I know you might be busy, but some of the other folks are committed to coming. So if you'd like to talk more and hear more and ask questions of our security, stability, and resiliency team, it'll be a very informal, no big production, just kind of sit down with the beer if we had one, chance to conversation with this team and kind of debunk the myths about, what ICANN does, but kind of showcase what they do at the same time, because it's pretty cool stuff. So I invite any of the newcomers to join the fellows Wednesday at 5:30 for that. So that'll be a good time. In our efforts to stay on time, Dave, I think I'm going to say I saw one question. So let's take the one hand. Gia, do you have the mic?
Yeah, it's with me. Do you want to ask a question?
Okay, too.
Thank you.
I'll try to be short on my answers.
Okay, in terms of, it's like a follow-up on the other question, but the
and
other El- way around.
Elsa, Elsa, your name for the record, babe.
Okay, Elsa Saade from Lebanon. I'm a fellow this year. Just as a follow-up, I want to make sure if there's a precedent to such a case, and has there specifically been a precedent where a government asked asked you or asked someone to take down a website or a certain blog post, let's say. It's not a blog post, like a domain name that is being used by a person who might actually be called a hostile group while they'd be... in certain countries where we specifically work, and I'm from the Gulf Center for Human Rights, hostile group can be a person defending a human right.
Yeah.
So has there been any precedent where a government asked for a turning down a specific request of a person who was called a hostile group but would actually be a human rights defender, and you gave it through?
So requests, absolutely. We get requests very frequently from governments that you would be quite surprised, asking us. what we normally have to do is kind of roll out, here is what ICANN does, and this is how the DNS works and how registration services work, and point out to them that in all this information that is maintained about the domain name system and who registered a domain, ICANN only has a little itty bitty piece, you know, and we don't even manage what gets put into that. You know, you just heard about the IANA. You know, what goes into the root is really the only part of the domain name system that we even edit, right? Everything else is what's called a delegation. So .com, .net, .cn, .jp, .uk, they all dictate what goes into their pieces or their delegations. So if someone comes to us and said, we think that, you know, that example.com is a hate site for whatever. Our response to them is the people you need to talk to and the attorneys you probably are going to have to discuss this with are the attorneys at VeriSign. So it's not so much that we wash our hands from it, but we literally cannot go into the internet and pull out a domain. There's no way for us to do that.
Hi, I'm Mona from Jordan. Your job is quite exciting that you get so much questions from us. I have a question about something I read in a novel. Actually, it's for a Dan Brown novel, but I want to ask true or not about analytics. Do you collect mainly used words in the internet to produce a sort of alert, like if a certain country or place used a few words that raises an alert, a yellow, then a red thing, as part of analytics? Is that true?
Let me see if I understand your question. Are you asking whether the information that we monitor also is keywords that would trigger some sort of alert to someone who's looking for terrorism and things?
Exactly.
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I'm really glad you asked that because often since I train law enforcement and post Snowden, I will get people, you know, from civil society, you know, and I'm very liberal, quite frankly, but I also don't like people hurting children. When I'm asked, what do we train them? Are you training them how to collect metadata? Are you training them how to look for keywords and things like that? Absolutely not. What we're training them to do is understand the relationships between a domain name and an IP address and a name server and the autonomous system number that they're all associated. So, for example, a website like www.securityskeptic.com, which is mine, the domain name, we all just know, and that's actually the host name. The domain is Security Skeptic. It's under .com, right? I will show the law enforcement how to do a whois to gather the information about, you know, what registrar I used, which is GoDaddy. And then since I live in the United States, my whois actually shows my home address and my email address and every place else that all the people in the criminal world might want to have, but notwithstanding, we'll also go and then say what IP address is this hosted at, and I'll show them that it's hosted in California in Mountain View by GoDaddy. Okay, my name server is hosted by GoDaddy. I'll show them what those things are, and then I'll show them that there's actually something called an autonomous system, and I show them what a good registration and a legitimate site looks like. Then we'll go into my spam folder, and we'll go and we'll grab a domain, you know, that is used to emit spam, and we'll walk through the same things, and I'll show them, you know, exactly what it looks like and how different it is. The information is generally incorrect in the whois. The location is generally in a hosting site that we know certain things about, and we can say they're not as trustworthy or they're one of these bulletproof sites. And so our model is a fingerprint. We tell people, we tell law enforcement, the way that you match a fingerprint is on the basis of the numbers of matching minutiae, little points that match between fingerprint at a crime and a fingerprint that you have in a criminal database. So we explained to them, you know, here's what you need to do. You need to get a body of evidence or a number of minutiae that would withstand court scrutiny. And that's all we train them. You know, from there on, they use the same tools that we use to go find phishing and, you know, and create block lists. But no, I'm not real interested in monitoring, you know, free speech and suppression. And I don't think anybody at ICANN is interested in that.
Thank you, Dave. And if you would pass that to our good friend, Chris Lahat. Thank you so much, Dave. Yeah. And I like the way that last question was really well-timed in part of what Dave was talking about, that our security, stability, and resiliency team provide, which is education and training. And so whether it's for law enforcement or for your internet society or your technical society or whatever group you're with, you can request that our security team come and provide a training. Now, there's a lot to be done to prepare for that, but it's available. There's a major part of their job is to outreach, engage, educate, and train. So it was a nice segue out. Thank you, Dave. We're going to go fairly quickly through this last part just as a little wrap-up for you to get ready for the week. I want to just point out certain places that you can go to find information that you need. What you've probably seen around the conference already are monitors, and the monitors have Twitter feed. They'll have Flickr photos. You'll see photographers everywhere taking pictures, and hopefully you'll pop up on one of them if you're in the sessions. And you will see, most importantly, the schedule. The schedule normally is solid and does not change, but it's always good to check the monitors for your rooms and times and locations. You can always go to the links that I have here, and I want to emphasize again that you don't need to be everywhere in this conference. Don't try to get to every session and absorb all the information, because each session, each open and public session, is recorded and transcribed, and if applicable, is translated into the languages that we're live streaming. In this case, we have Russian, Arabic, and Spanish for this session, and those are the languages which will be recorded, transcribed, translated. And they'll be posted on that second link there forevermore. And you can go back to other ICANN meetings and find all the information as well. All participation, I'd like to point out, while you're here at this meeting, you can be here in the main auditorium, engaged in this presentation. You can also go to the schedule, click on a session, and bring up another session and watch the remote participation and the presentation on silent, of course, because you need to have your computers muted, but with a headset, certainly listen. For newcomers, I do not encourage that. You know, I'm 56, maybe I'm too old to believe in multitasking anymore. But I think the point of being here face-to-face is to be present in the moment in the room that you're in and take in everything that's to offer by the presenters and what's happening in that room. Again, you can go back later and find the others. But if you cannot be at a meeting face-to-face, ICANN always provides opportunities for remote participation through Adobe Connect. We also provide opportunities for remote hubs. If you can gather enough people in your region or community, we do have an application on the meeting website that's open before each meeting, and you can actually host a remote hub. So today, the last two things for today are right here in this room at 4:45. Ira Magaziner, who is a name associated with internet governance, with the IANA transition, with ICANN. He will be here with several representatives from Capitol Hill and with the community to talk about this transition in a very conversational way to bring you further into the engagement for the rest of the week. We also have, just before that, immediately following this, to go down to Wicklow M3. It's a very casual way to meet some of our community leaders and staff members, and they will talk to you about if you're in the government sector, how do I follow this agenda, these 200 sessions all week? If I'm from civil society, what are my best bets? Where should I go and listen to? What supporting organization or stakeholder group should I listen to? If I'm security or technical background, what are your suggestions? And so we offer this just as a resource. The folks will be there for about a half an hour in Wicklow M3 right after this session. And there's no agenda to it. They're just going to be standing there in the room ready to take some additional questions and give you guidance. Now we're to Monday, which is why I have my good friend Chris Lahat here. I'm just going to quickly go through each day, but Chris has something on Monday and Tuesday, and he'd like to just share that with you. So, Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris Lahat. I'm the ICANN Ombudsman. Completely different subject listening to. But if you want to find out more about how the Ombudsman works within ICANN, I have a training session tomorrow at 12 o'clock at Liffey BR1. And anybody is welcome. And as an extra incentive, or you could call it a bribe, there are Ombudsman chocolates. So you can find out why ICANN has an Ombudsman, what we do, and also on Tuesday at 5 o'clock in a less formal setting, we have a reception where we just bond over a few drinks. I'm not going to say any more. You've heard lots of words. So I've mentioned the two magic ones, which are chocolate and drink. And you can lock those in at 12 o'clock tomorrow and 5 o'clock on Tuesday. Thank you, Janice.
Thank you, Chris. I think you need to sign up on the 12 o'clock to get to the drinks. That would be the way to get them from the education to the engagement.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm going to just promote that the fellowship program, though the applicants are selected on an online program to come here, be travel funded, to come here and be with me all week, those lucky devils. The sessions are open for everyone. So any one of the fellowship sessions, Monday through Wednesday, and there are several, some in the morning, some in the afternoon, you are more than welcome to come and join the session to talk to the chairs of the groups and that kind of thing. So a big focus tomorrow is the welcome ceremony led by our CEO, Fadi Shahadi, providing you with an oversight of what will happen during the week, some key points. We normally have dignitaries from the city that we're in or the country that we're in, and I understand there might be some dancing involved as well. And just general discussion about what to look forward to. So everyone normally is right here in the auditorium, filled to the brim to go over that. I'm not going to hit every one of these, but there's something for everyone at ICANN. So if you're a woman and you're working in this great internet environment, there's something for you here. There is a beginner series on a more technical aspect, but from the basics that our technical team here is presenting. There are four sessions tomorrow throughout the day, 90 minutes with breaks in between on how it works. So those are very engaging. DNSSEC for beginners. I always encourage our newcomers to go there. It is community members who put this skit about the domain name system security together. And it's just a great way to learn more about the domain name system and the security surrounding it. Tuesday, I find, is the hardest day for our newcomers. This is because acronyms are abounding in the sessions, and the community members are engaged in a continuous conversation, one that started last month or 2 months ago or 6 months ago at one of their webinars or conferences. And it seems like there's a continual flow of conversation that you are not being invited into. What I encourage you to do, and again, if you go to the sector stand-up downstairs, you will get a good idea from the community and staff that from the civil society, as I say, or from government or technical, from the end user perspective, you know, how do you get through those days? And they'll give you some great tips of how to understand how you would fit into the not-for-profit community, the non-commercial community, the business users, at large, the government advisory committee. So they're going to give you tips if you just want to spend even 15 minutes with these folks downstairs. Great tips on how to get through tomorrow. But I encourage you to explore. As I told my fellows this morning, it's about passion when you're in ICANN. It doesn't have to necessarily follow your job. You should follow your heart and your passion. If you want to volunteer your time somewhere, you want to enjoy that time, whether it's for Habitat for Humanity or rescuing cats and dogs. It's something you're passionate about. So apply the same principle to ICANN. You'll be passionate about your choices here, and there are many. So you can test and taste tomorrow throughout the different sessions. I encourage you to do so. Also, on Tuesday and Wednesday, the board meets with each of the groups. And I encourage you to go to some of those sessions because it gives you an overview of what's important to that particular community. That's what they're sharing with the board. What's important to us as a business community? What's important to us as a country code naming supporting organization? And they have the board's ear for 45 minutes or an hour. So it gives you insight. If you can't go to all the sessions, this gives you good insight. Well, yeah, that group, they're touching a nerve with me with what they're asking the board. That might be a good place to start. Just a suggestion. And when the board meets with the government advisory committee, sparks normally fly. So that's always kind of a cool place to go as well. We point out the IANA stewardship transition, of course, but internet principles. If you're from this European region, then you might want to go to the European coordination session and meet your European representatives to learn what's important for this region to work on. I skipped, didn't I? There. I'm so fast with a flicker. Nope, I did. I did well. Huh. So Thursday's our wrap-up day. Internet governance at 9:30 here in the auditorium. A great way to understand ICANN's role in the internet governance ecosystem that Nigel touched on this morning. And he'll be leading that session, so you know it's going to be good because Nigel just has that spirit in him. So it's a great way to go explore a bit more into the ecosystem that ICANN is part of and hear more than just the ICANN viewpoint. The public forum here in the afternoon at 2 o'clock, three times a year, we get to, as a community, to stand up at the microphone and direct our questions or comments directly to the board. Once a month, the board meets, but those are closed sessions just for board members. So three times a year, their board meeting is open. An agenda will come forward on Wednesday that will say, here is how the forum is divided up. Maybe from 2 to 3:30, we're going to talk transition and accountability. Maybe from 4 to 5:30, we'll talk about any other business or new GTLDs. Our supporting organizations and advisory committees are the ones who come up with that agenda with the board. What's the most important things that we want to hear from our community? Then you, as a community member, can gather your thoughts, and a time is set for each comment at 2 minutes, and there'll be a clock at 2 minutes that will count down from the minute you step up to the microphone. Not daunting at all, please, really, don't worry about it. So my advice is, if you have something to say or to ask, write it in your tablet or your phone or your iPad, and rehearse it once or twice and get it to the timing so that when you present yourself in front of the community or the board for the first time and you say your name for the record, you'll be noticed. If you're part of NextGen at ICANN, say, I am NextGen at ICANN. If you're part of the fellowship program, even an alumni, say you are from the fellowship program. If you are new to ICANN, say, I am a first-timer here at ICANN. It gets the attention of the board. I'm not saying that to have everybody go nanu nanu at you. It's because we are interested in having you here. I said it this morning. I'll say it again. So if you declare yourself that way, the ears perk up to say, we need to pay attention to this comment. And it goes on the record. Don't be afraid of the public forum. Everyone did it the first time. We've said that as well a couple times. And everyone has an equal right to come up to the microphone and say what they want to ask. There is no question that is, here's my former teacher and me, that horrible word, stupid. Those questions don't exist here. So ask the question if you need to. The public board meeting comes directly after that. It's a matter of passing resolutions. So what you'll get is a summary of the week. Here's a resolution passed because this agreement was met here. Here's a resolution passed. This agreement was met there. Okay, so that's all about Thursday. Now the fun. So the men have got to come out here because we always have things for women at ICANN, and the men are sitting back saying, how come nothing for me? So be the one who starts it. Go ahead and create a men's social. The door is open. Someone started the women's breakfast somewhere, and it's become very popular, and it's open to anyone. So that is tomorrow morning, just down the street at the Spencer Hotel at 7 a.m. Really, men not allowed. I'm sorry, guys. Monday night is the gala street fair. There will be more information about it, but what we do know is you have to pick up your bracelet at the INEX, our local host, booth down in the sponsor area. No one gets turned away from a gala. It's free by the fact that you registered and came here. But you do need to get the bracelet. If it's still open today, I believe we're open until 6 o'clock today, registration. The booths, I believe, are open till 6. And tomorrow as well. That will get you access into the pubs. So the most important 2 days at ICANN is some pubbing. So don't forget to get your bracelet. There'll be shuttles taking you there. They'll be picking you up in front. The shuttle schedule also at the local host desk and at registration. We'll give you that information. Chris talked about his reception. Wednesday, we also have another reception from our regional host here in Europe and our EURELO, which is Europe Regional At-Large Organization. So we have our big at-large organization broken down into regions, and this is our European region. Thursday, we have a wrap-up social for everyone, again, as a celebration of getting through the week. We love to celebrate as well as work. This presentation, again, is available to you if you click Newcomer Session. So you can look at this at any time. It gives you information about when the booth is open. We have a great tool called Quizlet online, which you can use to bust these acronyms all the heck out. So when people start to say GNSO and SO and AC, you can just go into the Quizlet and immediately find that acronym and what it means. Or raise your hand and say, stop the bus. Somebody tell me what that means. You can do that in any session too. When the meeting ends, we want you to continue to engage. So we invited you here to learn, and we would like to have you continue with us. So from a regional perspective, we have stakeholder engagement managers and vice presidents in each of our 5 ICANN regions. If you write to engagement at ICANN.org, that's actually Deborah and I, big secret, and we will make sure that you get hooked up with all the email addresses. Another big secret, every staff's email address is first name, last name at ICANN.org. So we're pretty transparent. You can kind of find us anywhere anyway. You can join My ICANN on the ICANN website and personalize the feed of information that comes to you. If you only want to hear from us once a week, click on once a week. Done deal. That's all you're going to hear from us. But it's a way to keep updated on your terms, on your time. As far as the Development and Public Responsibility Department, of which Deborah and I are part of, you can go to our page on the website and to find out about ICANN Learn, our online free training program and education program. You can find out about Fellowship, NextGen, our academic outreach, and other global events that we represent. Our parting thought here is a quote that I didn't come up with, obviously. But ICANN is not a fortress. It is an oasis, and Fadi actually termed this when he started with ICANN. and he wants to make sure that everyone always understands that it's all about you. You know, me coming to ICANN made no sense. I was a teacher, and I worked for Disney for 21 years. It made no sense for me to be here. But here I am 9 years later, and it's the human element. So we want to continue to make this a place for everyone to come and feel like they have a home, they have a voice. What's happening in out there in the world affects the internet. The internet affects everything happening in the world. And the only way that we can make sure that this ship stays steady and grows and evolves with the generations that are coming is for each and every one of you to take part and to encourage others like you to take part. And let's kick the old fogies out and let's bring the new blood in and keep this ship going in the right direction. I thank you all for being here for a very long day. I appreciate the heck out of this group of Next Gen, and don't think I didn't notice you being here today, and I hope you've learned a lot. We're here all week, folks. The staff job is to support the community. So come find us at the information booth, track us down in the hallways, ask us questions, and engagement at ICANN.org afterwards of anything that we can do for you at all. So if you'd like to go down again to Wicklow MR3 and join some of our folks to learn a little bit more about how to get through this week, I encourage you to, and then make your way on back up here around 4:45 for the IANA transition session. Have a great week. No, seriously, get out of here.